What if this guy doesn't need to go to the bathroom?
Don't worry, he will. My guess is he's been up for almost 3 days straight, and he's probably had 20 cups of coffee. Rapp looked over at the door and then back. Any questions before we get started?
What if I give the signal, and 2 seconds later he turns around and starts coming back?
Rapp nodded and pointed to her. Now that's a good question. If that happens, tug on the rope 4 times, nice and hard. Rapp watched her nod and then again asked, Any more questions?
Yeah, said Reilly. What if I have to go to the bathroom?
Hold it. Rapp reached into his pocket and pulled out a Velcro patch and one of the mini surveillance units. I want you to install this while you're down there. Lay it flat like this. Rapp set the small device in the palm of his hand and held it horizontally. This little wick at the end contains a fiber optic camera. Make sure it has an unobstructed view of the bunker door. Reilly took the device and nodded.
I'm ready when you guys are.
Milt? Rapp looked at his partner.
I'm good to go.
Good. Rapp brought his hands together and said, Let's do it. Rubbing them, he shrugged his head toward the second door and said, Let's get that thing open, and then we'll lower Anna down. Adams walked over to the gray door and extracted his S key. He opened the outer door, and there stood a sturdy steel door with rivets securing the hinges and a handle on the right-hand side. Adams brought his face to within inches of the control pad and then stopped. Stepping to the side, he looked at Rapp and said,
You better give this a try. You're going to be on your own when you open the second door.
Rapp agreed and stepped up to the control panel. He entered the 9 numbers from memory and pressed Enter. Immediately there was the hiss of air releasing, and then a metallic click. Rapp stepped back and brought his submachine gun up. Adams looked at him and pointed to the handle.
Just lean on that thing and she's all yours.
Rapp pushed Adams completely out of the way and pressed down on the handle. He didn't expect any trouble, but now was not the time to be lax. Rapp pushed the door in. Before him was a small landing and a set of stairs. The floor and lower half of the walls were covered with a brown carpet. Rapp stood hugging the door frame with his silhouette minimized. The thick black barrel of his MP10 searched every inch of the dimly lit staircase before him. He turned to Adams and Reilly. Everything checks out. Let's get Anna on the move and hope this guy has a little bladder. A minute later, Reilly was wiggling her way back into the vent and Rapp was playing out the rope. When he reached the vertical shaft, Rapp carefully eased her down it. From there, Reilly inched her way through the narrow confines until she came upon her spot. Gingerly, she inched forward the last several inches and peered through the slats. The high-pitched whine of the drills filled the air. Clutching the surveillance unit Rapp had given her, she looked out intently at the large, shiny door of the president's bunker. No one was in sight. The pudgy man that she had seen the time before was not visible. Reilly watched the 3 bulky drills working to breach the door. She wondered briefly if she should tug on the string and give the signal. After a moment, she thought better of it. She could see only part of the room, and for all she knew, someone was in there, or he was gone and could be on his way back. Taking the arm of her bulky sweatshirt, Reilly reached in front of herself and cleared out a spot for the Velcro patch. She secured the surveillance unit to the spot and made sure the fiber optic camera had an unobstructed view between the bottom of the opening and the first slat. With that done, she stretched out and tried to get comfortable. Wicker had a crew of 8 motivated Navy SEALs working feverishly. Planning ahead, as always, Wicker had called a lumber yard in Forestville, Maryland, and placed an order for the supplies he would need to build the shooting platform. When his CO, Lieutenant Commander Harris, had given him the green light, Wicker was on the phone within seconds. SEAL Team 6's strike element, which would be used to chase the terrorists if they left the country, was billeted at Andrews Air Force Base, where they were biding their time in hopes that they would be sent into action. Wicker explained his situation to the unit's executive officer and told him that Harris had given him the okay. Wicker requested 6 men specifically, and within 20 minutes they had borrowed a truck from the motor pool and were on their way to the lumber yard. The fact that they had not obtained authorization for the truck was something the paper pushers could sort out later. By a little past 2 in the afternoon, they were downtown in their jeans and t-shirts unloading their equipment. Everything was ferried by hand up the bell tower of the old post office, and now the men, all of whom were experienced snipers, were putting the finishing touches on the platforms. Building one platform would not work. 2 shots would be fired by 2 men using 50-caliber rifles. Although the platform's construction was sturdy, if only one were used, the slightest movement by one man could send the other man's shot dangerously awry. The 2 platforms were actually rectangular boxes constructed of 1-inch plywood and reinforced by 4x6s and glued and screwed together. Wicker grabbed a hard plastic rifle case by the handle and laid it down on one of the platforms. With the others watching, he popped the clasps on the case and opened it. Inside sat a massive 50-caliber Barrett rifle. 61 inches from muzzle to shoulder butt and weighing 30 pounds, it was one of the largest rifles in the world. It used the powerful 50-caliber Browning cartridge and was capable of taking out targets at distances in excess of 1 mile. Wicker, not a particularly large man, was only a half foot taller than the rifle. Scooping the heavy black weapon from its foam encasement, he pulled the fixed bipod into its extended position and set it down. He climbed onto the platform, slid in behind the rifle, and drew close to the scope. He peered through the circular eyepiece, and within seconds, he was staring at the hooded terrorist sitting in the guard booth on the roof of the White House. At this short distance, the 50-caliber Barrett would normally be way too much firepower, but considering the security afforded the terrorists by the bulletproof plexiglass, it was the right weapon for the job. Not just one Barrett, but 2. Wicker shifted his weight and moved subtly while he kept the crosshairs of the scope centered on the hooded man 620 feet away. There was no wobbling. The platform was sturdy. Satisfied, Wicker stood and placed his rifle back in its case. While he put the case back in the corner, his men went to work to complete the project. Wicker looked at the setting sun and noticed a change in the weather just over the horizon. A welcome change. Grabbing the digital phone from his hip, he punched in a number and waited for the person on the other end to answer. Chapter 44 Reilly didn't have her watch and had forgotten to ask what time it was before she was lowered into the vent. From the stiffness in her hip, she was guessing that she had been in the tiny space for at least 30 minutes, maybe even an hour. For the better part of that, she had seen no movement from the room. With nothing else to do, her mind wandered and fatigue set in. Several times she caught herself dozing off only to have her head bob back up and bump the top of the vent. The cramped confines and the drone of the drills reminded her of lying in a tanning bed. That she was not seeing any sign of the terrorists began to make her nervous. She started to wonder if the room was vacant, if now was the right time to give the signal. The problem was that she couldn't see all of the room. If they did this again, she reminded herself, ask for a watch and a better set of instructions. As the minutes passed by, Reilly grew more stiff and tired. Finally, when she was really beginning to doubt that there was anyone in the room, she heard a sound that was different from the steady drone of the drills. She squinted so she could get a clear shot through the slats, and Reilly saw something move. It was a shadow. There was someone in the room. A moment later, the pudgy man she had seen on her previous trip stepped into the full view of the open door and stretched his arms above his head, his potbelly bulging outward. She watched as the man moved out of sight and then approached the drills to measure their progress as she had seen him do on her first trip. When he was done taking his measurements, he tossed the tape measure onto something that was not in Reilly's view, and then, with his hand stretched over his head once again, he started down the hall toward her, his mouth agape, a yawn squirreling its way out of his rodent-like face. Reilly's face grimaced in disgust at the man's slovenly appearance and harsh features. At first, she drew closer to the vent and then quickly moved back for fear of being discovered. As he neared her position, the fingers of her right hand reached up and fumbled for the black loop around her neck. Reilly found what she was looking for, and as the man turned the corner beneath her, she pulled hard on the shoelace twice. Rapp and Adams had stood alert for the first 10 minutes, Adams standing by the open vent with the rope in his hands, and Rapp poised at the top of the stairs, his MP-10 strapped across his chest and his silenced pistol in his left hand. Rapp had decided that the submachine gun was too much to handle for this little foray. After 10 minutes of standing awkwardly across the room from each other, Rapp saw that there was a better way to utilize their time. Crossing over to Adams, Rapp had taken the rope and asked Adams to pull out his blueprints. After Adams spread the documents out on top of one of the containers, Rapp gave him the rope back. He then proceeded to pick Milt's brain on the layout of the West Wing, exactly where the tunnel came out on the other end, and what he could expect to find when he opened that door. Rapp and Adams had already gone over most of this before, but Rapp wanted to make sure he had a good grasp of the floor plan. He knew if he could pull off this phase of the operation, his next task would be to get into the West Wing and get a first-hand look at how the hostages were being held. From everything they could guess, and from what Reilly had told them, they knew the bulk of the hostages were being held in the mess. The problem that Rapp faced was finding out if any of the Secret Service agents and officers were still alive, and if so, where they were being held. As Rapp prodded Adams about the best way to check out the other areas of the West Wing, Adams lurched suddenly. Looking at Rapp, he spat,
"That was it. Two tugs."
Rapp was instantly moving across the floor. Looking over his shoulder, he whispered,
"If you get the recall sign, start calling my name and bust your ass down these steps so I can hear you."
Rapp was gone, into the tunnel, racing down the steps like a running back going through a set of tires. Out of habit, he had his pistol out in front of him leading the way. When he hit the bottom step, he looked briefly down the length of the tunnel and then turned immediately to his left. Leaping down the next flight, he came to a crashing halt at the reinforced door and switched his gun from his right hand to his left. Breathing a little heavier, he paused for a second to listen for Adams. Nothing. No warning from above. Pulling the numbers up from memory, he punched in the first 8 and once again stopped to listen. Not more than 2 seconds later, he punched the last number and stood back. The 9mm Beretta went back into his right hand as the rubber gasket surrounding the door hissed. There was the metallic click of the locking stems retracting, and Rapp's left hand shoved down on the door handle. It was no time to be timid. Shoving the door open 3 feet, Rapp led with the pistol. The first thing his senses picked up was the sound of the drills, and then a strange smell. His eyes picked up the back of the open door that led out into the hallway, and as he continued to open the door and step into the anteroom, the door hit something, and there was the sound of metal hitting metal. The noise startled Rapp, but wasn't loud enough to be heard over the clamor of the drills. Rapp slid around the door, leading with the gun, careful to show only as much of his body as necessary. Quickly, he jerked the pistol to the left and then the right, his eyes following. The room was empty. He approached the open door and took a quick peek down the hallway. Nothing. Taking a longer look this time, he looked up at the vent in an attempt to see Reilly. He was relieved to see that he couldn't. Returning his attention to the task at hand, he turned and looked for the source of his and many others' frustration. There it was, immediately to the left of the bunker door, touching the shiny polished steel. The black box was no bigger than a large stereo receiver. Rapp stepped over a toolbox and around another. Dropping down to one knee, he looked at the control panel and studied the dials and digital readout. The unit was manufactured by one of Westinghouse's little-known subsidiaries, who just happened to do a lot of work with the CIA, FBI, and Secret Service. Aziz had taken this baby from the Secret Service's arsenal. Rapp pulled the box away from the door so he could get at the wires and antenna in back. He grabbed a small pair of wire cutters from his web vest and lowered the arm of the lip mic on his headset. Rapp snipped the wire that led to the antenna.
Milt, can you hear me? Milt, can you hear me?
Rapp waited a couple seconds. After failing to raise Adams a second time, Rapp flipped the jammer onto its front and looked at the perforated black metal on the back. Through the cooling slats, he could see several bound groups of wire. Turning the thing off wouldn't work. He had to disable it. The key was to make it look as if it were still on. Rapp plunged the wire cutter in between two of the cooling slats. The pointy nose of the wire cutter bent the metal. Rapp twisted the tool back and forth several times to get more access and then opened the snips. As he clamped down on the first group of wires, it never occurred to him to unplug the machine first. Rapp squeezed hard, and as soon as the metal jaws of the wire cutter broke the protective insulation of the wires, sparks shot up, and Rapp was knocked back onto his butt. With tingles shooting up his right arm and feeling as if he'd lost all of the hair on his body, Rapp mumbled, "Shit." Shaking his right arm vigorously, he started to get back up. Over his headset, he heard the voice of Milt Adams and then someone else, a voice he didn't recognize. Irene Kennedy sat at her elevated position in the control room with a phone to her ear. On the other end of the secure line, General Campbell was explaining Lieutenant Commander Harris's plan to send in a small team of demolition experts to clear the path for the strike teams. Kennedy was not excited about the plan at first. That was until Campbell explained to her that Harris and the three men he had chosen had all succeeded in accomplishing what seemed to be the most difficult aspect of the operation during a training operation with the Secret Service some 8 years earlier. She still wasn't crazy about the idea, but the fact that they had already proven they could do it went a long way. As Kennedy listened to the general fill her in on the other aspects of the plan, her concentration was broken by a flurry of motion and voices from the two rows in front of her. When she looked up, she almost dropped the phone. The monitors that were showing the pictures that Rapp had already provided were now crystal clear, and smack dab in the middle of the big board was a picture of a shiny silver door that could be nothing other than the one to the president's bunker. Campbell repeatedly called Kennedy's name. After the third or fourth time it registered, and she said into the phone, "He did it."
"Who did it?"
asked a slightly irritated Campbell.
"Mitch did. We have a picture of the bunker on the board."
Kennedy paused for a second while one of her people pointed to his own headset and spoke to her. Kennedy clutched the phone and said,
"You'd better get back here right away. We have Mitch on full audio from his Motorola, not the field radio. I think he's taken out the jammer. Hustle back. I have to let Thomas know."
Without waiting for a response from Campbell, Kennedy hung up the phone and quickly dialed the extension for her boss. At the same time, she riffled through a stack of papers. Stansfield answered on the second ring, and Kennedy could barely contain her excitement.
"Thomas, Mitchell has taken out the jammer. We have him on full audio, and we've picked up two more surveillance feeds."
"I'll be there in a minute,"
Stansfield calmly replied. Kennedy hung up the phone and put on her headset as she called out Rapp's code name over the microphone hanging in front of her lips. She came across the document she was looking for, a list of numbers provided by Secret Service Director Tracy. Chapter 45. President Hayes looked at his watch. It was nearing 5 o'clock.
"Are you sure we shouldn't wait until it's dark?"
Jack Wart shook his head.
"I'd like to, but we don't know how much time we have."
All of the agents were either sitting or standing around the group of couches in the middle of the room. Warch had convinced the president that their chances for survival were better if they made the break. Valerie Jones had also agreed. Not that it made a huge difference, but at this crucial juncture, the less dissent the better. After getting Jones out of the way, Warch had brought the agents in, and they were now finalizing the plan. Warch looked up at Pat Cowley. Cowley was hands down the best shot of the group with either a pistol or submachine gun. The former Supreme Court police officer had just finished a 4-year stint with the Secret Service's counter-assault team, where he had spent the majority of his time riding around in the back of the old, black, armor-plated Suburban that followed the president's limousine wherever it went. These were the men that carried the big hardware. If the motorcade came under attack, it was their job to, first, cover the president's evacuation, and second, neutralize the threat if possible. Their basic doctrine was to carry enough firepower that they could enfilade the threat with a volley of bullets while the president was evacuated from the area. Warch continued going through the agents' assignments one by one. He picked two agents to leapfrog behind the point as they moved and assigned Ellen Morton and three other agents to stay with the president at all times. The last agent was to provide a rear guard if needed. Warch himself would stay fluid and try to lead as they moved. After all questions were answered and the evacuation routes were decided on, Warch got the troops lined up. 5 of the 9 agents carried MP5 submachine guns, along with their Sig Sauer pistols. The others, including Warch, were armed with their pistols only. With weapons checked and ready, Warch turned to Ellen Morton and said,
"Take the President and Valerie and put them in the bathroom. When we give you the all clear, you bring them out and we move."
As Warch turned for the door, he was interrupted by a noise he had been waiting to hear for more than 2 days. Simultaneously, every head in the room snapped toward the small kitchen table. On the second ring, Warch bolted toward the noise. Reaching out, he snatched his digital phone and pressed the send button.
"Hello?"
"Jack, it's Irene Kennedy."
Warch's heart was in his throat.
"Thank God."
Kennedy spoke quickly, her eyes staring at the monitor in the center of the big board.
"How's the president?"
"He's fine, but somebody's drilling through the bunker door. What in the hell's going on?"
Kennedy took a deep breath and started in.
"Jack, we don't have a lot of time, so I'll give you the short version. Rafiq Aziz and a group of terrorists have taken over the White House. They are holding hostages, and we know they are trying to break into the bunker."
Warch was a little surprised that Kennedy knew about the assault on the door. The president was now coming toward him from across the room.
"Well, what are you guys doing about it?"
"We're working on it, but we need to speak to the president first."
"Sure, he's right here."
Warch handed Hayes the phone, saying,
"It's Irene Kennedy."
Hayes took the small gray phone and held it to his ear.
"Dr. Kennedy?"
"Yes, Mr. President. How are you doing?"
"Good,"
exclaimed a relieved Hayes.
"It's great to hear your voice."
"It's nice to hear yours too, sir. But we have a lot to cover, and we're short on time, so I'm going to hand the phone over to Director Stansfield."
Stansfield and General Flood had just entered the room. Kennedy had her chair turned around, and as the men hurriedly approached their seats, she held up 3 fingers. Stansfield grabbed his phone and pressed line 3. In his normal, business-like tone, he said,
"Mr. President, I apologize for taking so long to get through to you, but we've been experiencing some difficulties."
"What in the hell has been going on?" asked Hayes.
Stansfield started from the top and moved through the highlights of what had happened over the last 3 days. He covered the demands that had been made and met, and those that were in the process of being met. He told the president of the murder of the National Security Advisor and his secretary, and the subsequent mental breakdown of his attorney general. He intentionally stressed certain events and exchanges that hinted at Vice President Baxter's incompetence. Stansfield gave him the soft sell. It was better to let Hayes come to his own conclusions than to hit him over the head with the obvious. The president, for his part, let Stansfield brief him without interruption. President Hayes was not happy about much of what he heard. The only bright spot thus far was the news that Stansfield had managed to get someone inside the White House. And not just anyone, but the man he had just learned of several days earlier. the man the president knew only as Iron Man, a man that had been billed as the absolute best Thomas Stansfield had ever seen. When the director of the CIA explained the vice president's reaction to the news that Aziz was in the process of extracting the president from his bunker, Hayes lost it.
"He told you to do what?"
Hayes's face was tense with anger.
"He told us that before he would risk the hostages' lives by ordering a raid, we would have to present him with more precise information."
Hayes shook his head. "It sure as hell sounds to me like you had pretty good information."
"Yes," replied Stansfield. "We felt so, sir."
"Well, get him on the phone so I can give him irrefutable information that he's an idiot." Now came the time for Stansfield's calm vision. His ability to slow things down when they seemed to be speeding up for everybody else had been one of his greatest assets over the years. That, and his ability to approach a situation like a grandmaster and plot his moves far in advance. Stansfield was pretty confident where this entire situation was headed, and for now, he knew it was best to keep the knowledge of their contact with the president to a bare minimum. In regard to putting the president in touch with his next in command, Stansfield said,
"I would advise against that right now, sir."
"Why?"
"We have suffered several leaks from the vice president's camp thus far."
Stansfield paused, giving the president time to digest the innuendo.
"We know that Aziz is monitoring the news, and I would not want it to leak out that we are in contact with you. We need to let Aziz continue to think that he has the upper hand. General Flood and General Campbell are in the process of putting the final touches on an assault plan. As soon as they are ready and you give the order, we can end this."
Hayes thought about the decision. His mind was made up almost instantaneously, and then he paused, wondering why Baxter hadn't given the approval. Turning his back to the group of agents and his chief of staff, he asked, "Why hasn't the vice president given this order?"
"I'm not sure, sir. I have some ideas, but I don't think you're going to like them."
"Try me."
"I think it would be best if we waited to discuss them face to face."
Hayes nodded.
"All right."
Then, moving on to practical matters, he said, "I'm assuming that the powers of my office have been transferred to the vice president?"
"That's correct, sir."
"Well, if I remember my constitution correctly, we have some procedural issues to take care of."
"Such as?"
"We need to inform both the president pro tempore of the Senate and the Speaker of the House that I am able to resume my duties. Technically, unless we do that, the transfer of power is not complete." Stansfield exhaled an uncharacteristic sigh. To someone who had spent years trying to skirt, bend, and sometimes break laws, this technicality seemed to be utterly trivial. He reminded himself that President Hayes was both a lawyer and an amateur presidential historian. Stifling the temptation to tell Hayes that it was a waste of time to discuss such a point, Stansfield instead said,
"Sir, you are the president. The powers of your office were transferred to the vice president for the sole reason that we could not communicate with you. That is no longer the case. General Flood and I are going to take our orders from you. If you feel that it is absolutely imperative to inform the vice president and the Speaker of the House that you are once again able to discharge your duties, we can do that in the minutes just prior to the raid."
Hayes thought about it. Always a stickler for detail, he wanted to make sure everything would be legitimate.
"That sounds fine to me. I just want to make sure those calls are made."
"We can do that, sir."
Hayes turned and looked at the bunker door, the humming sound of intruders just on the other side.
"Thomas, what are we to do if they breach the door before the strike teams are ready?"
Stansfield paused for a moment and looked at Kennedy. Kennedy was listening in on the call, and she pointed to herself. Stansfield nodded for her to go ahead.
"Mr. President, it's Dr. Kennedy again. We are monitoring your situation and have both audio and video surveillance of the bunker door. Iron Man is very close by. If it appears that they are about to get the bunker door open, we can order him to prevent that. In addition, the FBI's hostage rescue team is deployed across the street at the executive office building. They have a pretty good idea of where the hostages are being held, and, Kennedy sounded less than enthusiastic, if we really need to rush it, they can be inside the West Wing within 30 seconds of the execute order. Hayes picked up on Kennedy's tone and said, I get the feeling you have some reservations, Doctor. Aziz brought a lot of explosives with him, and he has threatened to bring the whole building down if there is any rescue attempt. Hayes thought about this new disturbing piece of information. Any chance he's bluffing? None at all, sir. Can we handle this? Kennedy looked up at her boss and General Flood. We're working on it, sir. The sun was falling in the western sky, and from the east a solid wall of gray was approaching. Salim Roussan stood near the tailgate of his ambulance and looked in both directions. A deeply superstitious man, he did not like the foreboding change in the weather. One of the other ambulance drivers had stopped by and introduced himself, and as luck would have it, the man was gay. Instead of the disguise working as a repellent, it had done the opposite. After several moments of idle chit-chat, Roussan made up the excuse that he needed to run and make a phone call. When the other ambulance driver offered his cell phone, Roussan declined and stated that in addition to having to call his boyfriend, he also had to use the bathroom. He turned and started walking to the east down Pennsylvania Avenue. Just a dozen paces later, he approached two D.C. cops manning the barricade at 14th Street. "Excuse me, officers," he asked. "Can you tell me where I can get a bite to eat?" One of the officers eyed him with a frown, while the other paused for a moment and then pointed down the street. "If you head down East Street here, you'll run into a deli and a couple fast food joints." Roussan smiled and said thank you as he passed the two men. Then, turning, he asked, "Will I have any problem getting back to my ambulance?" "No, we'll be here for a while." Roussan turned on his toes. He ducked under the blue sawhorse at the far end of the intersection. He was immediately pleased with the volume of people. After pressing his way through the crowd, he found that it ran about 10 people deep and then loosened up. A large concrete trash can, overflowing with trash, sat behind the crowd. There must have been a McDonald's nearby, because 8 or so of their bags littered the immediate area around the receptacle. All the better, since the bomb would do more damage lying on the sidewalk than in the garbage can. He pulled one of the cans of Diet Coke from his fanny pack and bent over. Taking one of the spent McDonald's bags, he wedged the can in with the rest of the refuse and set the whole package back on the ground. He positioned the bag so the majority of the blast would be directed toward the crowd. Roussan stood and started down the sidewalk again. He would come back the same way and make sure the bag was still there. Up ahead on his right, he could make out the ugly brown surface of the Hoover Building. He wouldn't go that far, although it was very tempting. There were too many cameras and too many professionals with a trained eye. Roussan would play it safe for now. There was no need to risk exposure. Chapter 46. The conference room at the Counterterrorism Center at Langley was bustling with action. The room was actually a room within a room, built several feet off the floor and surrounded on four sides by glass. It was enveloped in an electromagnetic field that made eavesdropping impossible. Irene Kennedy stood at the front of the room with General Campbell as the meeting attendees filed in. Director Roach and Special Agent Skip McMahon of the FBI entered the room with Thomas Stansfield holding on to each man's elbow. The elderly director of the Central Intelligence Agency led them to where Kennedy was standing. Stansfield released his grip on the men and said,
"Irene, I was just filling in Brian and Skip on Iron Man."
After hanging up with the president, Stansfield had sealed off the control room. No one was to breathe a word that they had reestablished contact with the president. Stansfield, Flood, Campbell, and Kennedy were the only people outside the control room that knew. The men from the FBI would be informed of this piece of information by the president himself. Kennedy was half ready to have Skip McMahon chew her head off until Stansfield said,
"I was telling Skip and Brian that you had wanted to let them in on what we were doing with Iron Man. I take full responsibility for this, gentlemen, and I have good reasons for doing so."
"Such as?" asked an edgy Skip McMahon. Stansfield played his old man status for all it was worth. Reaching out, he patted McMahon's large forearm and said,
"That's why I like you, Skip. Always vigilant, always pressing for the whole story."
"That's right, so let's hear it."
"I'm afraid that will have to happen during a later conversation. Right now I have something I think you will be far more interested in. Now if you will please take your seats, we need to get started."
Stansfield gestured to two chairs near Kennedy, and McMahon and Roach sat. Stansfield turned to Kennedy and said,
"Let's get started."
Chapter 47. Aziz looked up at the digital clocks on the wall to his left. The clock closest to him gave the East Coast time. It was 6:29 p.m. He took the remote control and turned the main TV from CNN to NBC. The nightly national news was about to start, and he wanted to feel the force of America's number one news network announcing another victory for him and his jihad. When the overly dramatic music announced the start of the program, Aziz grinned with anticipation as the logo flashed across the screen, followed quickly by the words, "White House Crisis, Day 3. Tom Brokaw came on, and after a brief lead-in, he cut to the United Nations in New York. The network's correspondent clutched her microphone and passionately retold the late-breaking news. The UN Security Council had unanimously voted to lift all economic sanctions against Iraq except those involving military imports and technology. The reporter went on to tell how Israel was the only UN member to protest the vote, but since they were not a permanent member of the Security Council, they could do nothing to prevent the lifting of sanctions. Aziz stood and smiled triumphantly. He had won again. Now all he needed was the president, and he would have complete victory. Aziz grabbed the radio and barked the name of his little thief.
"Mustafa!"
Aziz repeated himself two more times, and then one of his other men answered.
"Rafik, this is Raghib."
The man was standing watch in the basement by the door to the boiler room.
"I don't think he can hear you because of the drills. Do you want me to get him?"
"Yes."
Raghib let his radio fall to his side, and he walked down the hallway toward the bunker. When he rounded the corner, he yelled,
"Mustafa!"
The plump man appeared from behind the door and peered down the hallway. Raghib held up his radio and yelled,
"Rafik wants to talk to you."
Mustafa Yassin nodded and started walking toward Raghib. After taking his ear protectors off, he brought his radio to his mouth and said,
"Rafik, I am here."
The plump little man kept walking. The farther he got from the drills, the better he could hear. Back in the Situation Room, Aziz watched the UN story unfold on the TV and asked, "What is your progress?"
"I think it will take me about an hour."
"Are you sure?"
"I think so. The drills are getting close. Once they have reached their mark, all I have to do is take them off the door and... and then it should take me another 10 to 20 minutes of tinkering, and it should be ready."
"Call me when you are ready to take the drills off the door, and I will come over."
Yassin wasn't sure he heard him correctly, and yelled into the radio,
"You want me to call you when I'm ready to take the drills off the door?"
"Yes."
"Okay."
The dumpy safecracker turned and walked back down the hallway toward the bunker. Irene Kennedy and General Campbell were back in the control room getting ready to monitor Rapp's foray into the West Wing. Director Stansfield and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Flood, were sitting quietly one row behind, watching and waiting to offer their approval or opinion if needed. General Campbell turned to one of his staffers sitting to his right and covered the mic on his headset.
"Do another check on the communication links with Commander Harris, Delta, and HRT, and make sure we have backups in place."
The aide nodded and went about following the order. On the big board at the front of the room, several new shots from within the White House had been added.
The two that Kennedy and Campbell were most interested in were the images provided by the head cams mounted on Rapp and Adams. They had made it to the other end of the tunnel and were in position to open the door and enter the hidden hallway that led into horsepower and up a flight of stairs to the Oval Office. The danger, of course, was their inability to check what was on the other side of the gasket-sealed door. Back at Langley, a piece of intel had been collected that was creating quite a stir. Mustafa Yassin's conversation with Aziz had been picked up by the tiny surveillance unit that Anna Reilly had placed in the ventilation shaft. Kennedy immediately ordered Rapp and Adams into a holding pattern while they reviewed the tape. The words of Mustafa Yassin were replayed. When the segment was over, General Campbell looked to Kennedy and said,
"That's it. We're not going to make it. We have to move H hour up."
Kennedy agreed, and Campbell turned to the colonel on his right and said,
"Reset H hour for 19:30 and notify all commands."
Campbell then stood to join Kennedy, who was conferring with Flood and Stansfield. The commander of JSOC listened to Kennedy explain the new time constraints.
"We need to get Iron Man moving. We have less than an hour to collect and disseminate any information he can gather."
"I disagree," Campbell shook his head. "I think we should put Iron Man in a holding pattern until just before the strike."
"Why?"
asked a frowning Kennedy.
"Commander Harris and his team will be in position to jump within 20 minutes. I don't think it's worth risking a confrontation until we have everything in place. When we're ready to move, we do so with complete surprise and overwhelming force."
Flood nodded in agreement.
"And we make sure there is no chance Aziz can get his hands on the president."
"Absolutely."
Campbell pointed to the monitor on the board that showed the bunker door.
"With our surveillance, we can guarantee to stop him before that happens."
Kennedy folded her arms stubbornly across her chest.
"I disagree. I think we need to collect the intelligence. We can't send HRT in blind or it will be a slaughter."
Flood looked at Director Stansfield.
"Thomas?"
Stansfield stared at the big board for a half dozen seconds and then said,
"Let's consult Mitch. He's on site, and I'd like to get his opinion."
Without waiting for agreement, Kennedy turned around and grabbed the headset off her desk. Holding it over one ear, she adjusted the lip mic and said,
"Control to Iron Man. Come in."
Rapp was leaning against the wall by the reinforced steel door, waiting impatiently. His thoughts had drifted back to putting a bullet in the center of Aziz's forehead. Again, he had not shared this with the people back at Langley, and he wasn't about to. But if the chance came up, he was going to do it. Tactically, it made the most sense to him. Kill the leader and watch the others flounder. The voice of his boss interrupted his pleasant thought. Rapp pushed away from the wall and said,
"I'm here. Go ahead."
"It appears they will have the bunker door open in about 60 minutes.
There was a pause, and Kennedy added,
"We're not going to make it to H hour."
"Well, I'd better get moving then."
Kennedy
looked at the three men. "Have some dissension on how to proceed." Rapp rolled his eyes.
"I'm listening."
"The new H hour is set for 19:30.
Rapp looked at his watch.
"That only gives me about 48 minutes. Like I said, I'd better get moving."
General Campbell had grabbed his headset and was standing next to Kennedy.
"Iron Man, we will have Six's element in place in approximately 20 minutes. We don't want to risk precipitating a confrontation until we have everything in place."
"But we have absolutely no idea what we're up against there."
Campbell looked at Flood and said,
"Right now we think it's better that we retain the element of surprise."
Rapp was getting pissed. Milt Adams stood from where he had been sitting and asked,
"What now?"
Rapp waved him off and said into his lip mic,
"I disagree. If we don't find out where the bombs are and what we're up against, this is a suicide operation."
Rapp listened for a response but got none. He knew they were conferring with each other. Not wanting them to come to a decision without his input, he asked, "Why are we talking about changing the plan?" Kennedy fielded the question.
"The surveillance unit you placed in the ventilation shaft picked up a radio conversation between Yassin and, we think, Aziz. Yassin told him that he would be done with the drills in about an hour. After that, it would take him anywhere from 10 to 20 minutes to get the door open."
"Anything else?"
only that Aziz wants Yassin to call him when he takes the drills off the door. Rapp thought about the number of terrorists. The information they had gotten from Harut told him there were 11. He had personally reduced that number by 1, leaving 10 to be dealt with. Rapp tried to guess how Aziz would proceed with the next part of his plan, focusing on the operational aspect of how Aziz would have to extract the president. That was when it hit him.
Aziz is going to want to be there when Yassin gets the door open, right?
Campbell answered,
I suppose.
Not only will he want to be there, he'll have to be there. He knows the president has Secret Service agents with him, right?
Probably.
Whether he wants the president dead or alive, he's going to have to bring some firepower with him to deal with those agents.
Where are you going with this? Asked Campbell.
He's going to have to split his force. Our intel tells us Aziz went in with 11 people, including himself. He's down to 10. One of those 10 is on the roof, and 2 more are in the basement by the bunker. The plan crystallized in Rapp's mind.
The way we attack this is, we wait for Aziz to split his force. When they shut the drills down, we'll have a minimum of a 10-minute window of opportunity to strike. During that time, the number of terrorists guarding the hostages will be no more than 6, maybe less if Aziz brings more men over to back him up.
Back at Langley, the plan was gaining ground, especially with General Flood, a military tactician who loved the idea of dividing his enemy's forces.
Iron Man, I like the idea. Sit tight for a minute while we run this one by the president.
General Flood set down his headset and looked at Stansfield.
What do you think?
Chapter 48. Vice President Baxter sat behind the desk in his study and stared blankly at the TV. The images were nothing more than a blur, and the voices a hum of background noises. He was immersed in the thought of becoming president. It was so tantalizing, so tempting, it had drawn him into a fantasy world. Since early childhood, he could remember dreaming of being president one day, and now, with it so close, he had some reservations. Not reservations about assuming the office, but how it would play if word leaked that he had been given information that the terrorists were working on getting President Hayes out of the bunker. Baxter started to think angles. He started to think PR. First, he had been in New York when the whole mess started. He wasn't the one who had invited these terrorists into the White House for coffee. Second, he would somehow have to let it be known that the Pentagon's best and brightest had sworn the president was untouchable in his new bunker. General Flood's information that the terrorists might be attempting to extricate the president would have to be downplayed. They would have to say the information was vague and incomplete. On top of that, they could spin the story of the 2 SEALs getting caught in the ventilation shaft and Aziz's subsequent warnings. Dallas King would be proven right, though. Eventually, they would have to rely on the morally superior premise that they acted in the interest of saving the hostages. That in good conscience they could not have risked the lives of all those people just to make sure the president was safe, when, in fact, the information to the contrary was incomplete at best. Dallas King entered the room eating a banana. He said,
"We need to talk about something."
King continued walking across the large study. He sat in one of the 2 chairs in front of the vice president's desk and took another bite. Vice President Baxter picked up the remote control for the TV and hit the mute button.
"What now?" "Everything went off great at the UN, but I'm a little nervous about tomorrow."
"Why?"
Baxter placed his right elbow on the chair's armrest and rested his chin on his hand.
"I was just talking to Ted."
King was referring to the vice president's national security advisor, Ted Wilson.
"He says Israel is starting to make waves."
King sat back and took the last bite of his banana.
"What's their problem now?"
"They think they know what Aziz's final demand is, and they want it to be known that they will refuse to cooperate."
"What do you think the last demand will be?"
"They think he will ask the U.S. and the U.N. to recognize a free and autonomous Palestinian state."
"And?"
Baxter shrugged as if it was no big deal.
"Israel has sent word that they will not be bullied into any such agreement. Ted says his sources are telling him that in 4 hours, the Israeli Defense Forces will go on alert. And if Aziz demands a free and autonomous Palestinian state, the Israelis will occupy the territories. Baxter swung forward in his chair.
Damn it! You get their ambassador on the line and tell him if they do any such thing, I'll make sure their aid from us dries up to nothing.
King shook his head. You can't do that, and they know you can't. There are too many senators and congressmen that would come to their aid. Baxter's temper flared.
The hell I can't.
King looked at his temperamental boss and waited for him to calm. After several moments, he continued. Picking a battle with Israel is bad politics. It plays horrible in New York and even worse with our big donors out in Hollywood. I have an idea that might keep everybody happy. King sat back with a grin and crossed his legs.
On edge, Baxter blurted, Well, out with it. I don't have all day.
I think it's time to broker a backroom deal with them. We tell them to protest loudly if the demand is made, but to take no military action. In return, we promise that as soon as this next group of hostages are released, we'll retake the building.
I thought we didn't want to do that.
I thought so at first, King said cautiously. The more I think about it, though, you don't want to be seen as too big a wimp. If you can succeed in getting 2/3 of the hostages released and then give the orders to retake the building, King smiled, you will be seen as someone who was not just a good diplomat, but someone who can get tough when it's called for. To himself, King added, and you'll solve my problem in the process.
Maybe, Baxter frowned while he thought about this new strategy.
Then, looking at his watch, he asked,
Why hasn't Director Stansfield or General Flood come to me with this information?
King shrugged.
If Ted knows about this, they sure as hell do.
I don't know. Maybe Ted has a better source.
Come on, scoffed Baxter. Better than Thomas Stansfield? I doubt it.
Baxter reached for his phone and then realized he didn't know where either Flood or Stansfield was. One of the minions could take care of that. He had more important things to do with his time. Looking across his large desk, he said,
Get General Flood and Director Stansfield on the line for me.
Stansfield had decided it would be better if they called the president from the conference room, so he, Flood, and Campbell and Kennedy left the control room and entered the glass-enclosed bubble. In under a minute, both Rapp and President Hayes were on the line. General Flood gave the president a brief overview of Rapp's plan to wait until the last possible moment before launching the assault. President Hayes listened intently. The first question out of his mouth was,
What's the downside if our timing is off and we wait too long?
Hayes had an inkling of what the result would be.
If we miscalculate, sir, General Campbell paused for a second, we might jeopardize all of you.
General Campbell?
It was Rapp on the line. Delta Force is handling the mission, correct?
Correct.
How much time will it take to get them from the forward staging area to the White House, assuming the skids are warmed up and the shooters are locked and loaded?
Colonel Gray tells me he can put 12 operators on the roof in under 2 minutes and have 12 more on site within the next 30 seconds.
Excuse me for asking, back in the bunker, President Hayes was frowning, but if we can put that many people on the roof by helicopter, then why in the hell are we screwing around with parachuting these SEALs onto the roof?
General Flood fielded the question.
Element of surprise, sir. If we start moving the troops in by helicopter, the media and the thousands of people downtown will see them. We hope to land the SEALs and get them into the mansion without anyone noticing. It's risky, but it's the only chance we have of defusing some of the bombs so we can get the HRT in to save the hostages in the West Wing.
Rapp grabbed the chance to drive his plan home. And my point, Mr. President, is if we wait for Aziz and an unknown number of terrorists to head over to get you out of the bunker, we will significantly increase the chances of successfully rescuing the hostages. General Flood liked the idea and added,
It's a sound plan, Mr. President. We divide their forces at a time when you are still safe in your bunker, and our main concern is saving the hostages over in the West Wing.
Instead of having to deal with 8 tangos, we'll only have to worry about 5 or 6.
So, you're telling me it will increase our chances of saving hostages?
Yes.
Hayes didn't pause for a second. Then let's do it.
There was a knock on the conference room door, and then one of General Flood's aides entered.
Excuse me, General. The Vice President is on the line, and he wishes to speak to you and Director Stansfield immediately. If you'd like, I can have the call patched through to you here.
President Hayes's voice floated down from the overhead speaker system.
I think it's time we let Vice President Baxter know that he's no longer running the show.
Flood turned to his aide.
Patch the call through.
10 seconds later, one of the lines on the main telecommunications console started to ring. Irene Kennedy punched the proper buttons and brought the newest party into the teleconference. She nodded to her boss and Flood to let them know the line was up. Flood called out in his deep voice,
Vice President Baxter?
A woman's voice answered and told them to hold the line while she got the vice president. For more than a minute, the group sat in silence, waiting for the man who had initiated the call to join them. No one spoke. They all waited with anticipation to witness the ensuing confrontation between the two biggest players in American politics. When Baxter finally came on the line, he said,
General Flood, are you there?
Yes, I'm here with Director Stansfield.
Good, replied Baxter in a voice that implied anything but. I just received some troubling information.
Baxter paused, waiting for them to ask what it was. No one bit on his lead, so Baxter expanded.
My national security advisor just informed me that Israel has been making certain threats.
Baxter stopped again, waiting for Stansfield or Flood to respond. The two men looked at each other and said nothing. If it weren't for the tense situation, they probably would have been smiling, taking the time to enjoy the impending moment. Baxter started again, frustration showing in his voice.
Have either of you heard any of these rumors?
Yes, replied General Flood. We have.
Well, why haven't you bothered to tell me?
Flood looked up at the speakers, wondering when the president would decide to join the conversation.
We've been busy, sir.
Busy,
Baxter mocked General Flood.
Too busy to pick up the phone and inform the commander-in-chief of a crucial development.
Commander-in-chief.
President Hayes's voice floated down, neither angry nor calm, just supremely confident.
I don't think so, Sherman.
Only Stansfield kept a straight face. Flood, Campbell, and Kennedy all grinned with satisfaction. There was a long moment of silence before Baxter responded. When he did, it came forth with a combination of insincere relief and fear.
Robert, is that you?
Yes, it is, Sherman.
What happened? How did we get a hold of you?
Never mind, Sherman. I hear you've done a super job setting our foreign policy and national security back a half a century.
I don't know what you've been hearing, Baxter sounded panicked, but this has been no easy task, trying to save American lives and balance our foreign policy concerns. We have been working very hard to ensure...
President Hayes cut him off by saying... I have been fully briefed on what you, Marge Tutwiler, and your lapdog Dallas King have been up to, and I don't like one bit of it. I don't have the time, the patience, or the energy to deal with you right now, but when I get out of here, you are going to have some explaining to do.
But Robert,
Baxter's voice was cracking from the tension,
I think you have it all wrong. I don't know what General Flood and Director Stansfield have been telling you, but I'm sure I can explain. I have had the best of intentions in every decision I have made during this crisis.
I'm sure you have, replied a skeptical President Hayes. You've had your chance to sit on the throne, and you've screwed things up miserably. Now it's time to get the hell out of the way and let the professionals handle things.
But Robert...
But nothing, Sherman. This conversation is over.
All that was heard from the Vice President was the click of his phone hanging up. After a couple of long moments of silence, the president's voice floated back down, asking, Now, where were we? Chapter 49 The Air Force MC-130 Combat Talon cruised through the skies over Washington, D.C. at 10,000 feet. Part of the 1st Special Operations Wing, the Combat Talon was a unique asset in the delivery and retrieval of Special Forces operators. Lieutenant Commander Harris stood in the back of the modified C-130, looking out the open ramp and down at the city. The wind whistled through the back of the cargo area, and the four engines